we've seen a lot of pandemics in the swine industry. I remember the emergence of PRRS, the emergence of Actinobacillus pleuropneumonia. I remember PCV. And so we've gone through a number of experiences, and they've been difficult and costly to the industry. And frankly, there's more to be concerned about. So that's, first of all, the concern. As mentioned, I worked with USAID for almost 8 years on pandemic threats, more to the human population coming out of animal populations on most part. And we've seen successes and failures.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Hi-D is a pure, effective 25-hydroxy-D3 solution to help pigs improve their vitamin D status. Improve bone health and lifetime productivity with Hi-D. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/HY-D. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high quality, safe, and sustainable way. Healthier pigs are good for producers, people, profits, and planet.
Essential Ag Solutions, bringing innovative science-based solutions to livestock producers.
Good day. My name is Phil Hoard. I'm the host of today's podcast. Today we have Dr. John Dean joining us. Dr. Dean is Distinguished Global Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota, where he retired in 2023 after more than 30 years in academia. John, Dr. Dean grew up on a farrow-to-finish farm in southern Ontario. He graduated from veterinary school in 1984 and later completed a Master of Science focused on mycotoxin diagnostics, along with a PhD in epidemiology and economics. His career has spanned North Carolina State University, the University of Minnesota, and work around the world in epidemiology, economics, and animal welfare. Dr. Dean has authored or co-authored over 150 scientific publications and has spent meaningful time working with producers globally, including extensive work in China with Bob Morrison, as well as leading a USAID project on emerging pandemic threats across Southeast Asia and parts of Africa. Dr. Dean, thanks for taking time to share with us today.
It's my pleasure, Phil. I'm glad to be here.
So today we're going to be focusing our conversation on pandemic threats to the swine industry. But before we begin, John, would you give a short background for our listeners on your relevant experience and your work in this area, just to help us set the stage for some of the questions and content we'll go through today?
I guess there's 3 years of experience that really create my interest and probably also my biases towards the subject. The first is that we've seen a lot of pandemics in the swine industry. I remember the emergence of PRRS, the emergence of Actinobacillus pleuropneumonia. I remember PCV. And so we've gone through a number of experiences, and they've been difficult and costly to the industry. And frankly, there's more to be concerned about. So that's, first of all, the concern. As mentioned, I worked with USAID for almost 8 years on pandemic threats, more to the human population coming out of animal populations on the most part. And we've seen successes and failures. And finally, ASF has shown up on our doorstep in many ways. And so we've seen experiences in China, in Europe, on successes and failures in trying to control that disease as well.
No, I think this is setting up to be an awesome conversation. So having said that, you know, why are you particularly concerned at this point? I mean, you mentioned we've went through this, you know, in the industry with various things, but what makes, you know, today more concerning for you than ever?
I think there's, again, 3 areas to be concerned about. First of all, I think the U.S. industry is particularly susceptible to insults on demand. that we, if we have a disease in swine, there can be tariff barriers to exports or non-tariff barriers, especially in many cases. And with our price discovery system in the U.S. based on a small subpopulation of pigs, it can really destroy price discovery and create a quandary in our industry. I would add, secondly, that we need to be concerned about zoonotic diseases, those diseases that transfer from animals, in this case, pigs, to humans. And in that case, if we have an outbreak of something like a new influenza, we may not only see decreases in export demand, but also domestic consumption. And again, that insult on our industry can be quite a concern. Mm-hmm. I'm also concerned about diagnostics. Not all of these diseases are going to show up on the farm, especially our grow finish barns, which we have more of than sow farms, as a distinct disease based on what we call syndromic surveillance. In other words, clinical signs. And so it may stick around for a while before it really is picked up. The ability to differentiate, for instance, classical swine fever from a nasty PRRS is difficult to do without sending in samples and getting a differential test done. And that will just delay the ability to isolate the disease and control it. And finally, there's a welfare concern that if we stop movement of animals or see a difficulty in finding a buyer for our animals, there's a reluctance to euthanize these animals quickly, and therefore we end up with overpopulation, especially on our swine farms, and that can occur really quickly. And so I see time and time again that we don't spend enough time really taking into account all the areas that can be affected with a pandemic.
Yeah, and that's probably summarizing a lot of the concern that from a producer perspective we would have too. You know, I think there's obvious concerns that are from a, you know, you mentioned, for instance, a testing side, right? We have a lot of diseases and challenges that we deal with periodically that do have similar, you know, physical symptoms or clinical symptoms that a lot of times may not be exactly being tested for everything either, you know, and so that is an interesting thought too.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
What particular concerns for the U.S. as you think about the United States and how we have our industry comparatively to maybe other parts of the world and why, that, you know, other than the things mentioned, do you think that we should be concerned here?
I think I've seen quite a few cases where we do good work in our preparedness in terms of simulation studies, especially in Southeast Asia and Africa where I worked. But there's an old quote from Mike Tyson that said, everyone has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And we've seen these plans fall apart. And what we say theoretically doesn't always come in force when our livelihoods are threatened. And so I think we need more than plans. We need contingencies. agreements between parties, between, I think, especially in the United States, between state veterinarians on agreements and automatic steps in how we move forward instead of questions on how each state will react individually. And one of our big problems in the United States is that there are restrictions at state level, and we have imbalances between wean pigs and grow finish barns between states, and especially between our grow finish barns and our slaughter facilities between states. So we need that movement to avoid welfare problems and to allow some price discovery, some amount of money available to the farmers to proceed.
No, that is as you think about the concern for the U.S. and you're mentioning, the state by state desire to control things in a different manner than the state beside them, and et cetera, and the regionalization concept of being able to still move pigs. Obviously, there's been extensive work to try to be documenting movements and registering sites. And so there's still a good chunk of the industry that, from my perspective, I think is falling behind as things have advanced in the planning process to being able to be prepared, right? So I think, there's being prepared, like you're mentioning, and then there's, when things get really tough or you get punched in the mouth, right, what do we actually do? And for me, it's kind of been interesting to watch what's happened with avian influenza in a way. That's a very interesting thing for me to have watched, thankfully, from the sidelines. Our family doesn't own any birds. But, what would you have there been parallels there that you've been watching or that you've been observing that you would think we could learn from there, or at least see how it's practically happening?
Yeah, we've been watching it, especially in Minnesota, and we've had discussions back and forth on the subject. There's an interesting article that just came out in ProPublica questioning whether or not aerosol spread occurs between farms. And there still is a basic assumption that there is no aerosol spread, or it's very unlikely. And what I keep on arguing is, yeah, these experiments have been done between a dozen chickens or 100 chickens and another 100 chickens. But the game is totally different when you have a layer unit of 5 million chickens expressing virus, and there's another 5 million layer farm down the road. There's no way experimentally we can assess the risk, and we simply have to rule out the other methods of transmission and say, yes, it's probably aerosol in that case. And I think we see it time and time again, especially in ASF in China. There were assumptions about the disease and how it could and could not spread that were based on, how should I put it? That were based on a mechanistic understanding rather than a risk-based or economic understanding of how diseases spread and how farmers behave. I'd give the example that at an early meeting of discussion on the outbreak in China, most of the epidemiologic unit were actually virologists and not epidemiologists. And it's hard to take benchtop studies and really apply them to, I call it existential threats to our farm's existence.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that happen on farms today that are not easily replicated in a lab. We appreciate and value the work that starts there. And then I think we think that we've reach the top of the mountain in terms of understanding, and then we look up and we still have ways to go to feel like we've conquered it and understand it fully. And that's such a true statement, right? Is we can't, we have to have practical decision making and understanding of the modernized production today, whether it, whatever species it may be, when it comes to, and I would suggest too, as the farms have become larger and more animals are there, that does change the game, you know, versus maybe some of the work that was done in the field, or I think you were even involved in some of the early work of understanding, right? How far does PRRS or mycoplasma move in the air, right?
Yeah. We Scott D led a lot of that, and I was sort of the quantitative guy saying, first of all, when we saw transmission, we knew that it would be a high risk once we multiplied it out about across years and larger farms. But it's still limited in our understanding because we can't understand the lower risk events. Because we simply need to use the data in the fields. And that's where the Morrison Swine Health Monitoring Project, just taking field data and modeling that and understanding environmental influences and the like can be very useful in creating strategies.
Yeah, that's a great project. That has allowed us to really have a rooted in data, right, to really understand what's happening. Yeah. So what have you seen that works well in the control of new agents or new things that are coming around that, you know, we have obviously the ASF example here that, you know, while it's been around for a while, what do we see that works well in the control of these new threats?
I'm going to use some of my experience on the human side in this case, since the resources are much larger. And I do think animal disease control is an under-resourced area in many areas. We've seen it in Central Africa, in Southeast Asia, in China, that there's three parties that really need to be trained and coordinated in their approach. The first one is government, and where borders can be controlled, that's the limits of actual control measures in the area. And so I mentioned before, there's this conflict between state level control, where the borders theoretically are controlled, but they're very under-resourced. And then we have national control. And so we saw a need to create national controls on aspects such as especially current viral outbreaks in various countries. So government needs to be involved. They need to be able to act quickly, and thus, as I mentioned, have plans instead of simple observations. And so we've seen some countries take it to what's called the cabinet level, that there are actually positions within the cabinet for preparedness and rapid response. Because we end up with a lot of people who say they're experts, and I can even current outbreaks, I'll put it nicely, every MD thinks they're an expert, and yet their training in infectious disease and especially regional control is almost non-existent. And therefore, identifying the right experts are important. And we saw some much of that challenge in COVID. We had neurologists pontificating and without much evidence at all. So identifying the core, putting it at points of control is important. Second of all, empowering diagnostics. And We saw in China early on that diagnostics were limited to government agencies for ASF, and the turnaround was about 7 days to 10 days. And that was much too long to control an outbreak, even with a relatively slow moving disease such as ASF. Mm-hmm. It's nothing like the way PERS moves or influenza moves. And so once the farmers were empowered and had direct availability of diagnostic tests, which can be misinterpreted, but allow rapid response, that really changed the game as well. And so diagnostics are important. And third of all is down on the ground understanding of infectious disease control. Part of that is sanitation, biosecurity, but it's also having veterinarians, MDs, other professionals directly understanding what steps need to be taken. Even before the government says anything, if they know what they need to do, it's controlled in a much better manner.
Very interesting. So as you think about before the control of ASF, and I think it would be unwise to say that it's under control in China, but we could say, you know, when we look back, why did it spread so quickly, I guess, is the question then.
Yeah, essentially, those things that I said we needed did not exist in China. It was state level control. And it's hard to imagine, but let's say you always shipped your pigs across state lines. And in China, many farmers did that. And so it was hard to imagine on one side of the state line, their pigs have no value. And if it crosses the line, even late at night, they have value. And so not only do you ship all your pigs within a controlled area, but especially if you think you have ASF, you ship all your pigs. Second of all, of course, the problem was with feeding of swill. And the community was based on, in some ways, a very sustainable model of feeding kitchen scraps. That's Freudian slip, I think, in some ways. Yeah. I can report that early on, travel with Bob Morrison, and there were pigs underneath the toilets behind some of the restaurants in the less reputable places, and all the scraps and all the crap ended up down there. So you can imagine turnover of diseases, but that there wasn't an economic model to assure farmers of protection. And so once there were imbalances, it actually increased the amount of movement, I would argue, of pigs and diseased pigs rather than control them. And finally, as I mentioned, the information was so controlled by government that it impeded decision making on the farm. You may have heard of something called the tooth extraction method on farms, that if you diagnose the individual pigs early enough and do a perimeter removal of pigs around those infected pigs, they've stopped outbreaks on the farm. And I think most of our governmental agents can't even imagine such a rapid response for a disease, and yet it's one of the most successful aspects of control, other than a wholesale improvement in biosecurity on farms in China.
You believe, and it would be obvious or kind of understood, that the level and the amount of testing happening in China, for example, is probably greater than what we even imagine like, and from a U.S. perspective.
Exactly. And some of it's backed off, but doing environmental tests, tests of any dead animal, specializing in certain areas such as testing lymph nodes, doing saliva monitoring, all those aspects were being done in terms of hundreds of samples per day on some of these, especially larger sow farms. And the return was there. It was a successful method of controlling disease in the more advanced, knowledgeable farms.
In swine production, performance is everything. At Lupta, we know your success depends on measurable results. That's why our feed additives go beyond improving palatability. They're scientifically designed to enhance feed intake, support animal well-being, and drive optimal growth. From the wean transition to periods of stress, our solutions deliver what matters most: resilient animals, improved performance, and a stronger bottom line. Backed by decades of expertise and a commitment to innovation, Lupta is redefining swine nutrition. Because when your herd thrives, so does your business. Lupta, create, connect, inspire. Visit lupta.com to learn more.
I have a question for you. You know, in the U.S., there's been a lot of discussion and some research into more pen side testing or point of farm testing. Is that happening in places like China now? Have they been able to develop that technology to be accurate enough in this way, in your opinion?
Very much so. And actually, most of what we can do is based on the experience in China. And furthermore, in Southeast Asia, Thailand is doing quite a bit as well. I think to emphasize that the accuracy doesn't need to be as high. If we compare sensitivity, the ability to find a pig positive versus specificity, the ability to find a pig negative, there's a bias towards sensitivity on these farms. But that's a risk that on the farm you're willing to take. But at a national level, you would not be willing to take. But if we empower the farms to make that assumption, they've got a problem, shut down the farm, shut down movement, it meets all the aims of good disease control. And then it's up to government agencies to do what we call confirmatory tests, to have a higher level of specificity. And in some cases, prove that the farm did not have ASF, but it was a false positive. But we should be willing to accept that.
So how do we, kind of wrapping up our conversation, you know, how do we manage these, you know, existential threats that we have coming at us from your point of view here for our industry in the U.S.?
I tend to use the example of life insurance, that first of all, admitting that it's an existential threat, that if we have an outbreak of ASF or other diseases of concern, that we will see real financial insults unless it's caught very early and controlled very well. And if it is not, then everyone's going to suffer. And in many ways, those that are neighbors to the farms that are positive suffer the most, not the farm that has it because of ability to respond. But on top of that, I think if we talk about life insurance, the ability to continue to go forward and prosper as an industry, we need to create net present values of some of these insults. Simply say, what's the likelihood of, for instance, ASF showing up in the next 5 years? And past history gives a bit of a hint, but I don't think it's as strong a predictor as we want it to be. And yet, that's the natural tendency of everyone to say, my individual experience will predict the future. I think there's better predictions on outcomes. And then take that existential threat and say, how much is it worth per pig on our farm to invest in prevention? And most of that prevention is not at the individual farm level. It's at the national level. It's at the investment in response and the like. And we can easily come up with values, net present values of $1 or $2 per pig marketed this year. And if we take that and say, how would we spend that amount of money on making our industry safer against threats, it would be an amazing advance, I think, in many cases. I think in many cases, we've created insurance through price, through inputs, but not for diseases. And I think we can do a lot more there.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought there for sure. Anything else you'd like to share on this topic before we close up today?
Yeah, I guess I sound like a naysayer sometimes speak about things that are are subjects that we don't really want to discuss in polite, yeah. Polite areas, polite society. But I think it's like life insurance and wills and those areas. I think it should be a discussion with every employee, with all involved in the industry. As I age, the likelihood of mortality increases. I think we need to discuss and say, yeah, we're under threat. We need to keep on talking and discussing what we're going to do if it happens and how we're going to make ourselves as safe as possible. And I think we're getting somewhat complacent after the initial concerns about ASF, and it's still doing its march through Europe. And as you mentioned, it's still not under control in China and Southeast Asia.
Yeah, it's a good wake-up call for me as I think about this too, is that there's, you know, still ongoing conversation about it, but it is a very, very real threat amongst many threats to businesses today. And it's one of many, right? But it's a very real thing that will very much impact like you're mentioning, everyone in the industry's lives to one degree or the other. So thank you for that.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Vaccinova, formulate to your needs. Custom-made vaccines. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost pig health and performance. Nexus, powered by SAM, where science meets performance. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Uniferon 200 from Pharmacosmos, the iron dextrin for baby pigs, which promotes faster growth. Better production performance starts with Eastman Choline Chloride. Visit eastman.com. Tired of solving swine nutrition challenges alone? The Swine Nutrition Inner Circle connects swine nutritionists who share real insights on formulation, ingredient variability, and diet adjustments. When you need clarity, experts are just a conversation away. Join at swinenutritioninnercircle.com and connect with peers who understand the work you do every day.
So, switching gears, what is your favorite swine-related book or resource that you have used in your career or maybe even today?
It's surprising, but to me, but I've gone away from textbooks, like I think many of my students have, and I'm getting more excited about AI and just creating summaries. And I like those little paper clips at the end of the AI discussions that take me back to the references. But I'm surprised how much I'm using AI summaries to at least get me started. I don't think it should be an endpoint, but I'm a fan.
I use that a lot today myself. That would be probably my primary use for it, if I was being honest, is help me, you know, summarize this in a way that I can come up with, you know, like you're mentioning, using it as a guide or directive, but not the end all be all. So I appreciate that too. And so as you think about what is your favorite book or your resource that would be used today that would be either in the industry or outside the industry?
I just pulled up a book that I had read 25 years ago, and I realized how much it guided my my decision making. It's called Rainbows for a Fallen World, and it's by a Christian philosopher named Calvin Serfeld, out of Toronto, who recently just passed away. But it's a reminder that we need, as much as I'm talking about existential threats, we need to focus on beauty and truth and celebrate the good things that are happening as well. And I think sometimes we do not step back, for instance, at a faring crate and just look at the beauty of newborn pigs and things going right, and even the smells surrounding a faring room as everyone quiets down and the piglets are suckling.
I was in a farm last week and I did just that. I held a baby pig. It had been a minute for me, and that was really, it was just kind of a moment, like you're saying, there's a lot of things we are working on and that may not be going exactly how we want, but taking time to be like, hey, everything isn't broken, and, you know, in a world where it feels that way, right? So I can appreciate that. Thank you. Finally, in your opinion, what sets successful professionals apart from those that maybe are less successful, in your opinion?
I guess, first of all, we get down to the definition of success.
Yeah.
And I don't really consider it monetary in most cases. The people I've really enjoyed and consider my mentors are those that are inquisitive and want to keep on challenging themselves and each other going forward, and willing to say what may sound initially as a really dumb idea, but over time it grows on you. And so expressing a broad interest and expanse of knowledge about the industry really keeps me going.
I love that. Yeah, I can appreciate that too. Well, thank you, Dr. Dean, for your time, and we appreciate you being on the show today and the insights you shared with us, and thank you again.
It's been a pleasure.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.